You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Well, it's nearly the end of 2017, so time now for a brief review of the year for Pythagorean astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
It's been a few interesting stories this year, I guess. A lot of exoplanet stories.
Yeah, a lot of exoplanets. Some quite nice new bits of science to do with exploding stars as well.
Yeah.
Something very, a few interesting stories close to home too, with the sun and with the solar system.
Yeah, so it's one of those years that I thought when it started, there weren't many missions being launched, there weren't a lot of missions encountering their new, you know, their targets, their planets that they were going to orbit. So there wasn't a lot going on in solar system space science in terms of new things. So I thought it was going to be a sort of a dry year in that sense, and it's not been...
Well, that's, you know, you don't have fancy new toys to play with. You have to just get on and do your work. Yeah.
So let's make a start. I guess we should start with, let's start close to home. So something that came very close to home, but actually originated much, much further away, is something we covered last month, actually, Oumuamua.
Yep.
Which I think I pronounced vaguely correctly.
Yeah, sounded good. I hope you had the glottal stop at the beginning.
I did try with the glottal stop, yeah.
Oumuamua.
Oumuamua. So this is a Hawaiian name for an asteroid that came from very much from afar, from outside of our solar system, came flying in, whizzed by the Earth, and is on its merry way out of the solar system again.
Yeah, it didn't pass particularly close to the Earth. It was about... it was much further out than the moon is, but it passed pretty close to Mercury. So it came from, originally it was thought to be, you may remember, it was originally thought to be a comet because it was coming in at a right angle to the solar system. And if you think the planets in the solar system orbit around the sun like a plate, so they're all in a disk. And comets come from this weird thing called the Oort cloud, and so they have they can come from all sorts of different angles. And this strange thing came at one of those strange angles, and so a lot of people thought, oh, that's a comet, but it didn't have a tail, so probably not a comet. And then as it got closer, we realized it's more like an asteroid. And the trajectory that it was coming from and the speed that it was coming in, which was about 50,000 miles an hour, was indicative that it had come from outside of our solar system. So it's the first interstellar asteroid that we know about. If we've had one, we've almost certainly had many more. We just haven't realised that they're...
And there was an estimate that there's probably one a year, but we just don't see them because they're so quick that you miss
them.
Yeah,
that's right.
They're not only around for a few days, really, that you can...
Yeah, right. And this one was really detected as it was on its way out. It came in at 50,000 miles per hour, but when it was close to the sun, it was going four times faster, 200,000 miles per hour. So that's about 10 times faster than the fastest comets. So it's very fast.
And so given what was going on at the start of December with other investigations of this object, was it really an asteroid?
Well, it wasn't an alien spacecraft, which a lot of people thought. Sorry, Chris.
You disappoint me.
So there was some astronomers, or rather a rich philanthropist who has various projects with the Breakthrough subtitle. So Breakthrough Listen was the one to study Oumuamua. And he put in a lot of money to look at this with the Greenback telescope, so check the radio waves coming from it to see if there were any radio signals, because it was such a strange object that was coming in. But if you think about it, 200,000 miles per hour, it'll still take several million years to get anywhere. So if it was an alien spacecraft, they either live for a long time or they're in hypersleep. But you wouldn't choose to go on a weird orbit like that towards our sun.
It's also tumbling, so they'd be dizzy and presumably out of control.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And they didn't receive any radio waves from it either. Yeah. And the Greenback telescope could, if there was a mobile phone on this thing, it would have been able to pick it up. So...
you heard it here first. Aliens have mobile phones. these Breakthrough Listen projects, programs like that are looking for aliens. I think the main idea behind them is not that it's thought to be exceedingly likely that there'll be signals, but more that we kick ourselves if we didn't ask the question.
Yeah, exactly, so yeah.
It's worth just checking.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And so there's another one called Breakthrough Starshot, I think, which is one that we covered on the programme before, and that's the sort of fleet of micro-satellites that could be sent to Proxima Centauri.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, tiny spacecraft going to other star systems as a technology development program, I guess.
Exactly,
drive,
yeah.
Drive technology. Okay, so that's something that came very, very close to us. Sticking here on Earth, back in August, we had the solar eclipse. Not a major scientific breakthrough, per se, but something that probably the most watched eclipse in history.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell in modern history, certainly. Because it was coast-to-coast on the US, and a lot of people managed to see an eclipse. I'm a bit of an eclipse skeptic, because, not that I deny their existence, but a lot of people say that it changes them, it transcends everything that they thought about nature, and it's a really awe-inspiring, beautiful thing. I'm not denying that, but I've seen quite a few partial eclipses, and they've been pretty good, and I don't know, I don't feel that a total eclipse is going to be 50 times better.
I've not seen a total eclipse myself, but everyone who does see a total eclipse say that they do go in with that kind of point of view and then come out going, no, it was awesome, when's the next one?
Yeah.
So I do intend to see one at some point. So 2024, I think, is our next best chance of seeing one here in Europe.
Okay. Well, so it's going to be cloudy.
I guess through Spain, so, you know, it's sunny in Spain some of the time.
Yeah, that's right.
Moving out through the solar system, we had the end of a mission. So there were no new missions or no large new missions launched this year, but we had the end of the Cassini spacecraft in September, which was very much the end of an era.
Yeah, yeah. And Cassini had some, I think earlier in the year, had some really nice results from observations it had done of Enceladus, these black smokers. Well, what we think of on Earth as being black smokers, but actually more like white smokers on Enceladus, these hydrothermal vents that are leaking through the cracks in, or what's called the tiger cracks in the surface of Enceladus. And
and this is from studying the composition of the water that's coming out of these vents, these geysers that are spewing for Enceladus, which is one of Cassini's highlights of his mission, for sure.
Yeah.
These things exist. And I guess the question being now, how long will it be before we go back to Saturn? Who knows?
Yeah, potentially quite a long time. There are various missions that are planned, but they're quite distant. Mm. But the reason why it's significant, these smokers, is that on Earth there are these strange creatures, bacterial creatures, called extremophiles that live around these black smokers, these hot thermal vents at the bottom of our oceans. And that could exist, you know, we could have microbial life on Enceladus around this.
And actually here on Earth, thought to be a candidate for one of the places where life started because of the heat, the temperature, the energy source, all the nutrients that are there
welling
up from underground. So, yeah, very exciting to go and maybe drill down or melt down through the ice and go and investigate those in a few decades' time, no doubt.
Yeah.
But one to look out for. But moving outside the solar system, we've got quite a lot of exoplanet discoveries, as we mentioned this year. We've got the one towards the start of the year was TRAPPIST-1. This 7-planet system discovered not too far away around a little red dwarf star, so a star much smaller than our sun. And 7 planets in one system was quite a haul.
Yeah, and 7 planets is quite a nice number, because we have 8 planets in our solar system, and we're always looking for solar systems that are similar to Earth, not only for reasons of habitability and looking for alien life, but we want to know or understand better how our solar system formed.
And so there's a search been on. We've been searching for planets that are like the Earth. We've been searching for planets like the Earth going around other stars, so the same size, the same mass as the Earth, in the same kind of temperature regime in terms of distance from their stars. They might be able to have liquid water on them. And maybe, as you say, in the same kind of solar system with other planets. Here in the solar system, we have rocky planets on the inside and gas giant planets on the outside. We've seen all sorts of other systems that have a mismatch of of all these different planets. They have big ones in the middle and small ones outside and so on.
Yeah, and it's quite weird when you think that we're so used to having rocky ones all bunched up at the close to the sun, and then the gas ones that are quite spread out and very much further away. And then when you look into the rest of the universe, it seems to be a bit of a jumble. But I remember going to a seminar a few years ago where somebody was saying that actually planets migrate around in their solar systems over the period of millions of years. And that could be what we're seeing, you know, the different stages of big planets that have unstable orbits. We have nice stable orbits of our planets in our solar system. But if you have... Jupiter is a very disruptive influence, and the planets are quite stable, but the asteroids aren't stable. And what if you had more than one Jupiter in your solar system? It would be very unstable. And so this could be why we see such a strange arrangement. It's not telling you how they formed. It's telling you that you don't know how they formed, but you can see them now, and it seems to be a little bit of a mess.
And actually, when we look at the asteroids that have been disrupted by Jupiter, and we look at the Kuiper belt and the outer edges of the solar system, it becomes apparent that the planets in our solar system definitely have moved around. It looks like Jupiter's moved it inwards a bit, Saturn maybe outwards, Uranus and Neptune possibly even switch places at some point. There are simulations which endorse that. And this is all to do with the way the planets, as you say, they interact with each other, and you get something called resonances, where as Jupiter goes around two times, Saturn goes around three times, whatever the numbers are, I forget exactly, but certainly as Neptune goes around three times, Pluto goes around twice. And so Pluto is in this resonant orbit with Neptune. You get a lot of other systems with asteroids in these resonant orbits. And TRAPPIST-1, this star with seven planets going around, it had that system where the planets are in these resonant orbits. So they every time they went round, they lined up with each other again. That was interesting for seven planets. That earlier this month, it was announced that we've now found one with eight planets. So just like our own solar system, Kepler-90.
Yep. And like our own solar system, it has rocky planets towards the star and gassy planets further away from the star. Although everything is much closer to the star than it is in our solar system.
Yeah.
So that's interesting in its own right. But I think the most interesting thing about the story from my perspective is how this solar system was discovered, which was using not what we normally do, which is basically looking at each data set by hand. This one was done by a machine, an entirely machine learning algorithm. A neural network found this this set of planets around this star, Kepler-90, from... I think something like 35,000 candidate ones that the analysis pipeline had thrown up.
Mm. So, I mean, and the way this works is you feed the computer a set of likely candidates, or you feed the computer the rules for how to look for one of these events. So, what is a promising sign for this being? And it filters through all those rules and does the analysis much more autonomously and much more rigorously than a person ever could.
Yeah, that's right.
And much faster.
And it has a first cut, because Kepler-90 has, when you look at the data, you can see that the star isn't constant. It has dips in brightness, and that's sort of your first cut. You say, aha, there's something going on there. And then you monitor exactly the way that the dips happen, and that pattern is what the machine learning algorithm then goes into analysing that.
And all the more difficult when there are now eight planets there, because there are eight different sets. So each planet goes in front of its star from our point of view and dips the light a little bit, each with a different period, a different time between each transit, each dip. And so you've got eight sets of those potentially overlapping and wrapping around and all sorts of a bit of a mess, and the star fluctuating in brightness as well, which is why people looking for this is can be quite difficult to do.
That's right. Yeah,
we've also found planets and evidence of planets in all sorts of weird places. We had rings of dust around neutron stars, which are dead husks of massive stars.
Yeah, that in itself is very interesting. Because I remember back in, was it 1992, the very first extrasolar planets that were discovered were orbiting around a neutron star. And they were discovered in a way that actually is not a particularly high yield way of finding exoplanets. This method hasn't found many exoplanets in the past, and that's looking at changes in the blink rate of these neutron stars, and it's very nice to see. Actually, this could be the precursor to is the dust left behind because the star lived its entire life and exploded before its planets formed out of its the circumstellar, the material, the gas and dust that's surrounding the star, and now we're seeing the dust that's glowing after this explosion, or is this being accreted? Is the neutron star now accumulating the dust around it from the gas that's in its neighborhood, and we're now seeing it because it's taken such a long time to accumulate enough dust for us to see? It'd be very interesting if it was if it was the stuff that planets are formed out of, because that would then explain why the very first exoplanet system has three exoplanets that weren't obliterated.
And you have to wonder, does the supernova, when this star explodes in this massive explosion, does that disrupt the orbits of the planets? Probably not destroy the planets. It's not like you see in science fiction movies that get ripped apart by a shockwave, but it could disrupt their orbits and so
yeah,
on.
That's right. Yeah. But you could also form dust in the supernova explosion, which would be a very interesting thing if there was, after however long it's been since the supernova, that there's now been enough time for that dust to form.
Yeah, probably not very nice planets to live on from our point of view.
Yeah, that's so, right.
Maybe not.
Yeah,
go-to destination.
It'd be very, very cold.
Yes. Now, speaking of supernovas and exploding stars, we had the star that would not die last month. So this was a new type of supernova, possibly a new type of exploding star that we'd... it turns out we had seen before.
That's right. We've been seeing it for the last 60, 70 years since... I think it was 1954, and that's a very interesting thing in its own right, the fact that this thing has exploded many times, or has appeared to explode. There have been sudden brightenings over the past 60, 70 years. And that it's still a mystery why we see something that looks like a supernova going off. And if you remember, I spoke to my colleague Yair Akavi about this, who was the principal scientist in this study, and it's totally baffled him what it could be. One of the explanations could be that there is a shell of antimatter and that keeps being formed inside the star, and it just sort of in the very edge of the star, the outer layers, and that interacts with the normal matter and has this violent explosion that doesn't destroy the star but causes an awful lot of light to be released.
So it's an explosion on the surface of the star rather than something going on right in the core.
Exactly, which is more like a supernova, that the star blows itself apart.
We've also seen other types of odd supernovas. So there was something we discussed at a journal club, is how I noticed it last week. So this is a very, very distant supernova. It's at, in astronomy speak, it's at a redshift of 2, which means it happens about 10 billion years ago, so when the universe was less than 4 billion years old. The most distant supernova discovered, in fact, what's called a superluminous supernova, so which is just a very bright supernova, brighter than it should be. And they've been studying this superluminous supernova to figure out if they can figure out why it's particularly bright, whether there's anything particularly special about it, and in doing so realised that a little while beforehand it also had a peak in brightness. So maybe this is another thing that has exploded before and is now exploding again. So
superluminous supernovae are interesting for all sorts of reasons, because we tend to think about supernovae as being standard candles. So they have... a particular type of supernovae, what's called type 1a supernovae, which involves two stars, and it involves a white dwarf and a large star, normally a red dwarf star. And the white dwarf is sucking material off the white red giant, and at some point it goes critical, it has too much mass, and it explodes in a supernova explosion. And people think, well, there is a limit to... the amount of material it can take on, and that then gives you a limit to the maximum brightness this thing can have. And if you have a superluminous one, how do you make that? And it could be from two white dwarfs. So if you have a system which has two white dwarfs, then and they go supernova together, then you could have something that's twice as bright as a normal type 1A supernova, which is in itself, that's called a super Chandrasekhar superluminous black superluminous supernova.
Wow, we're getting lots of supers in there.
Yeah, super.
The really super thing we had this time this year was the kilonova, the binary neutron star, the gravity and light explosion. It had all sorts of names. The short gamma ray burst that was seen. This was the event in August this year, announced in October, of the merging and the explosion of two neutron stars. The first time this has ever been witnessed and shown to be two neutron stars, because it was witnessed in gravitational waves and with light in all sorts of wavelengths.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. And actually, this is something which is close to both Chris and I. Chris working on the gravitational wave side, and my colleagues in Las Cumbres working on the supernova side.
And so this proved that binary neutron stars were responsible for something called short gamma ray bursts, a particular type of burst of gamma rays that are seen all over the sky. So that answered one question. But it also let us study one of these, because we got warning that this was happening, or we got we got alerts from the gravitational wave community and from the gamma ray community that you guys with your networks of telescopes all around the world could go and find the object and look at it just decaying away.
Yeah, and actually that's an incredible technical achievement to not only coordinate astronomers from totally different fields to alert astronomers from a yet another different field that there is something that they should go and look at, keep it all secret, and then say, well, it's a pretty large area of sky you now have to look at. And actually, my colleagues in Las Cumbres and Yaya Akavi, who I mentioned earlier, was one of these. They did quite a clever technique. They assume that the kilonova is going to happen, not a star at random just in space, but that star is going to be inside a galaxy. And we know where the galaxies are, so we then target the galaxies that we can see in this area of sky, starting in the very center and then working your way out. And various people had various different methods. And we were hoping to be the first. We weren't the first. I think
A few hours, right?
Yeah, that's right. We were 45 minutes slower than the people that detected it first. The rather annoyingly named Las Campanas Observatory, very similar to ours, which is Las Cumbres Observatory. But what we could do is we could, unlike many other observatories, because we have this global network, we could observe this thing changing at far higher cadence than them. So we could look at it every 8 hours, whereas most people could look at it once every 24 hours.
So, you managed to track it over over the course of a few days, which was gave us some very interesting insights into what was happening with this particular event.
Yeah.
Now, the gravitational wave detectors that discovered that are down for an upgrade for the next about year, and then they'll turn on again about this time next year is the plan. And we shall see what they reveal in, I guess, probably 2019 by the time more results come out. We'll see exactly what happens.
Yeah, it's very interesting because LIGO and actually this kilonova discovery was the first time that really the Virgo instrument came into its own in pointing out that because both LIGO detectors saw something and Virgo didn't see something, that actually you could triangulate, because Virgo had a blind spot in a very small place, and so you could say, ah, well, it must be in that blind spot.
Yes, fascinating result, very exciting to work on, and actually one that it had to get put out because there were so many astronomers involved, had to get published on a relatively quick timescale. A couple of months to go from discovery to the full papers is a pretty short timescale in these things. So
So it was October was the announcement, and the discovery happened halfway through August.
So there's been lots going on way out in the solar system. We've also had things going on here on Earth. We had all sorts of natural disasters recently in Puerto Rico, and hurricanes, and there have been earthquakes and so on. And You might not think that astronomy can help with some of these natural disasters, but in fact, it can through the efforts of many, many people and a large number of telescopes and something in this case called the Zooniverse, a set of projects that use data and let people, citizen scientists, try and help out. Something called the Planetary Response Network, which sounds like something out of the Avengers or something, I think.
Yeah, or Thunderbirds.
Yeah, set up to help with the recovery from some of these natural disasters. And I spoke to someone heavily involved in that, Brooke Simmons. In the summer of this year, I guess it was August time of this year, there was a lot going on in the world, but particularly in terms of natural disasters. There were various hurricanes and storms, particularly over in the Gulf of Mexico and over in the US. And you started this Planetary Response Network. Tell us a little about the network and what you were doing with it.
Well, it was actually a little while ago we realized in the Zooniverse, which is the crowdsourcing platform that I use to do a lot of my astronomical research, and I have colleagues from around the world, and of course we work with volunteers from around the world. We realized that a lot of the work that we do in astronomy and other sciences could be equally applied to satellites not looking up at space, but looking down at the Earth, and understanding what was going on about the changing Earth, and particularly for dealing with disasters. So when, you know, Hurricane Harvey hit, there were a number of things that happened back to back earlier in the late summer and autumn of this year. We started to talk to some of the charitable organizations that we've worked with about how we could help with a response for that. And particularly what we ended up doing was deploying after Hurricanes Irma and Maria, which came through the Caribbean. And so we started, it was actually just the start of September, and we collected satellite images of areas that we started with, say, Guadeloupe, Dominica, Puerto Rico, St. Martin. We looked at a lot of different islands. And just looking at images from before the hurricane and images after the hurricanes and asking what had changed. So we had over 5,000 volunteers visit the site and tell us, you know, they saw blocked roads, they saw damage to buildings, they saw flooding, and in fact, when they told us they didn't see anything that was just as important. And we combined those inputs into what we call heat maps that showed where the changes were, where the most urgent help was required. And we sent that to the charity we were working with called Rescue Global. And they use that to inform their response in all of those different islands.
And I guess a lot of the islands you talk about have a relatively poor infrastructure at the best of times. And so after a
very much
hit,
so, yes, indeed. Yeah. So they really needed our help. Yeah, it was really good to be able to help.
And did it take long to put it together? You said when Hurricanes Irma and Maria hit, was this something that you did in a few days to kind of throw together as quick as you could? Or you said you've been planning for a while and you've got a bit of the groundwork done already?
Well, we'd done some previous, I would call them deployments. We did a project after the earthquake in Nepal a couple of years ago, and then we did another one after the earthquake in Ecuador last year. So we kind of knew what to expect, but of course every disaster is a bit different. We were able to do it so quickly because we'd already done those previous projects, and because the Zooniverse, the platform that we were using, we were able to build a project really quickly because the Zooniverse has a project builder that I know very well and all my colleagues know very well. So we could put the project together within, I think it took me about an hour the first time. And then what we had to do was process the data itself, and that involves partially just waiting for the data to become available. I mean, hurricanes are obviously, it's a big cloud formation, and you have to wait for the clouds to clear before the satellites can see the ground again. And then we have to process that into manageable pieces and go back and forth with the response organizations about what we actually need to ask about and what's going to give them the best information. And all of that did take no more than a couple of days. In some cases, in the middle of the project, like after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, we had to wait a little longer for the clouds to clear, and that was a little frustrating because everybody was waiting, including our volunteers. They kept asking us, you know, where's the data? We want to help, and we just had to wait. But it was very quickly came together, and then we were able to follow up and continue on. So we went for almost 3 weeks in the end.
So you use data from various sources. So I mean, when we think of
Earth observation satellites. You get things like, you know, weather satellites, communication satellites, and so on. You get a lot that are looking down at the ground. You get satellites from NASA, from the European Space Agency, and from all sorts of places that are scanning the ground for various reasons. You used a range of sources to do this, though. Is that right?
That's right. Partially that was motivated by the need to just use what was available, and particularly whenever images were publicly available, like NASA and ESA both make images publicly available, we'd use those if we could. But we also have some partnerships. We worked with a company called Planet Labs, or I think they changed their name recently, so they're just Planet now. They're a really, really great company. It's a commercial satellite company. They have CubeSats, and they cover the globe with the CubeSats. So they just have images like popping up and available pretty much every day. And they let us have access to those areas so that we could pull in the images. And Digital Globe also made images publicly available. And the other thing about the different image sources is that they're different image quality. And that's not, I mean, it's not that one of them is better than the other. It's that they're targeting different things. So NASA and ESA both have satellites that cover larger areas. And the pixels are sort of larger sizes. So somewhere like 8 to 10 meters is a single pixel. So that enables you to look at large areas for things like landslides, but it doesn't really let you see, say, how much damage has been done to a single house or something. Whereas the images from Digital Globe were like 50 centimeters across, like per pixel. And so they cover a much smaller area, so they take a lot longer to look at the same area, but you get a lot more detail. And Planet is somewhere in the middle. It's kind of a sweet spot. It allows you to cover a pretty large area, but still see reasonable detail. So we used what was available and tried to optimize for whichever case was the most important. Like if we were looking for flooding, you sort of are fine looking at larger scale things with less resolution. Whereas if you want to know what buildings are damaged, you want something higher resolution.
That's actually astonishing. I don't think I realized that we had CubeSats up there that had 50 centimeter resolution.
Digital Globe is the company that has the 50 centimeter resolution, and that is a full task satellite. The CubeSats have like 3 meter resolution, but they're continually working on it actually, and they're getting better every day. It's a really great company, and they have a really nice kind of atmosphere and a theme that they're going for is to help the planet. And part of the reason that they chose satellites that would have imagery at a few meter resolution is so that they wouldn't be available to like really high resolution stuff, like trying to find somebody's license plate. They were more interested in like how we're going to help, you know, agricultural solutions and help understand the changing, you know, the changing earth, the changing climate, ecological things, research things, and also commercial applications too. We really like them. They're great to work with.
I guess these companies rely on the commercial applications to fund them, to allow them to build the satellites and so on. And as a result, they can do these kind of things, which are, it would be a shame if you had to buy these images, right? That would prohibit anything like this. So
it really would. And they both, both the companies we work with so far, they have specific programs. Our program with Planet is one where we ask them every time we have a specific case, and they, you know, they just sort of vet it and then give us access, pretty much whatever access we've asked for so far. And then we, you know, we let them know afterward what we've done with the images and how their images helped. Digital Globe they have a program like that as well. And they have a program, both of these programs are open to academic researchers, not just in disasters. And Digital Globe makes the post-disaster imagery publicly available in an open data program that they have, and we use that too.
It's kind of what you want to think satellites are invented for, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing we should be doing Earth observation for.
Yeah, and that's, you know, all the things that pay the bills are just fine, but it's really great that we get to help people with it.
And so do you have any assessment of the impact? You say, you know, we get to help people, and Rescue Global use this data. Did you get feedback from them on any specific things they're able to do as a result of it at all?
Yeah, we did. They were great. They really kept in touch with us, and not just when we were planning things, and we'd ask them, like, is this the right way we should be asking this question? Is this going to get you the right information that you need? And so on. They were really great about feeding back about that. But then while they were in the middle of deploying, I mean, sometimes they'd be doing flyovers of areas that, you know, had been marked for that they needed more information on and so on. And then they'd come back and they'd let us know what had gone on. They let us know, for example, that they were able to get some people evacuated to another island that at the time was safe. because our maps enabled them to have a better ground assessment. For example, in Dominica, which was hit quite hard by Hurricane Maria as a Category 5 hurricane, and didn't really have, like, they didn't have the U.S. infrastructure to help them, or they're an independent island, so they really needed help. We helped them in multiple ways, partially with the whole maps of the island. They used those maps to help them decide where to focus their initial efforts on, say, road clearing and so on. But they also are a couple of our volunteers spotted early on, even before we were finished with the full island classification, that part of the main airport, the runway was blocked. So they passed that on to us, and we passed that on to Rescue Global right away. We heard later that they were able to use that information to make sure they could make a safe landing. They used airplanes. They also used helicopters. And then while they were there, they also were able to get some engineers that were stuck on that side of the island over to the other side of the island so that they could start work on repairing the power plant that had been badly damaged. So those are like individual examples. We also had some examples from Turks and Caicos. And we also know that Rescue Global shared our maps publicly, and they shared them directly with multiple other organizations, including the Red Cross. So they got used in a variety of different ways. And we had great feedback.
It's a wonderful project to have happened, to have helped all those people. And you said, did you say 5,000 volunteers looking at the images? Was that?
Yeah, it was like 5,300 volunteers who were registered on the site. We had more than that who, you know, never logged in. But that's a little harder to count, and we can't give them credit unless they log in. Mm-hmm. So it was like 5,331, I believe. Mm-hmm. They are individually mentioned and given credit on the website for having helped us.
And they're distributed all over the world, presumably.
Yeah, we find that it's funny. I once downloaded a map. There's a website you can go to. I can't remember the URL, but it shows essentially all the ongoing humanitarian crises in the world, which is quite sobering. And then we overlaid with that. I was giving a talk once, and I overlaid the map of the Zooniverse volunteers. And they are also over the world, but it's not an even split. And in fact, it's almost an inversion. So the places that are more likely to be in crisis for various reasons are a little less likely to have a lot of Zooniverse volunteers. And the places that are doing a little better, which is, you know, a lot of North America and Europe and so on, Australia, they really contributed a lot. We had volunteers from all over. And the Zooniverse as a whole has volunteers from, I think, just about every country except maybe North Korea.
There's probably a seasonal message in there somewhere about people coming together to help everyone else. If you want to link it to the time of year at the moment, I suppose. But,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does feel good to be able to help in some way, small or big, whatever it is.
And I mean, the other thing that I guess is on my mind is that you said you have volunteers, 5,300 volunteers who helped out to look at it. Your job presumably isn't to do this. So, well, it may be, but I'm guessing it's not.
Correct.
So a lot of the effort from yourself and your colleagues over at the Zooniverse is volunteer time effectively as well, right?
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, I should say that the reason we're able to do this in part is because the infrastructure that we use for the Zooniverse and actually some of the algorithms that we used were built to do research, to do science research. Including astronomy. In fact, the algorithm that we used to combine all of the volunteer classifications into very accurate maps was developed by our computer science and machine learning partners, and it was originally tested in a supernova project for astronomy in the Zooniverse. So they really blend together very well, and I mean, the Zooniverse developers and the Zooniverse community is really great. I was very lucky because I wasn't teaching, and I didn't have something that needed my urgent attention, so I was able to set everything aside for this brief period of time. And the Zooniverse developers also did the same, and we got kind of lucky with the timing, but also it was really through the concerted effort of many, many people that all, you know, set aside what they were doing, including people who didn't directly work on, say, helping with whatever the code was in the Zooniverse offices, but they took over the important jobs that had been, you know, like one of our developers, Amy, was working on something else. And so she set that aside to work on the Planetary Response Network. And then other developers took over what Amy was doing. So really everybody helped, not just the people who worked directly on our code.
Is this going to become more routine over years, do you think?
I think it might. It really depends on the need. I think we're really need-driven. A lot of our projects, well, all of the projects in this universe are need-driven in a way, because all the research teams have a research need that is being addressed by the project. It's just that with the Planetary Response Network, the need kind of pops up at an unexpected time, and then it can go quiet for a period of time as well. So we only run a project when we know that we're working with a charity or a response organization or decision makers that are going to use the input and the work that the volunteers give us. So we anticipate that we'll be doing this multiple times in the future. We'd like to not have to. We'd love it if the natural disasters just stop forever, but unfortunately that seems unlikely. So we're kind of on hold and ready to deploy as needed, and hoping to be able to further develop this universe to make that even easier for us in the future.
Well, it's as you say, in an ideal world, these wouldn't be required, but it's great that so many people can come together and develop and build something like this to help with all these cases. So, Brooke Simmons from UC San Diego, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
I'm not sure whether this is the first time I've seen this kind of response from astronomers to these events. It's great to see it happening, isn't it?
It is. I really like the Zooniverse platform as well, because it seems like you need a lot of money and effort and coding skills to put together one of these projects. But the Zooniverse have actually made it very, very simple. You can just follow some instructions on their webpage, upload a whole load of images, and then you have a ready-made Zooniverse project. So if you had a load of images and you wanted to see if there was a penguin in them, you could upload all of your images and set some questions, and the interface would just show whoever went to this website a random picture, and then you could ask them questions on it. It is a fantastic thing that you could do with just, if you're a teacher, you could do it with your class, you could have small projects on that scale. Right the way up to you, I spent some time earlier this year making a project to find asteroids in Las Cumbres data, and I did it in exactly the same way.
It's it's certainly a nice thing. I'm hoping to use it for some gravitational wave data linking with the LCO, the Las Cumbres Observatory, as well in the coming year. So a very nice platform to be able to use. Well, that's it for 2017 from Pythagorean Astronomy. Don't forget, of course, pythagastro.uk is where you can find all the episodes. Wish you a very happy new year and all the best for 2018. Goodbye.
Yeah, I hope you have a good one.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.